Evan Strove from Bulletin Place in Sydney, thanks so much for joining me on 2SER this morning.
Absolute pleasure, mate. I'm very, very happy to be here.
You identify how the perception of native ingredients in Australia have gone through a transformation in recent times, and how what was once considered bush tucker is now found on menus at Australia's top bars and restaurants. What do you think has driven this change?
Interesting question. I think you look at the big culinary giants of the world. You look at places like France and Italy and Japan, and they have this kind of very established identity when it comes to food and drink, and a kind of long history that's connected to that. And I think for a very long time, we haven't necessarily been able to identify that in Australia beyond the concept of bush tucker or, you know, meat pies and pavlovas and that kind of thing. And I think restaurants are beginning to, I guess, do the research, look at what grows naturally, look at the kind of cultural tapestry that's attached to that, and incorporate it in food and drink. And we're beginning to see a conception of Australia that is both quite new, but it's also very, very old at the same time.
So who are some of the main bars and restaurants that have been leading the way in the use of Indigenous ingredients?
So there's a couple of quite well-known restaurants. The first would be Orana in Adelaide, headed up by Jock Zonfrio, which a lot of listeners might recognize from MasterChef. He's one of the new judges. But he, since opening Orana, has had a very strong focus on telling a story of Australia and its landscape through the lens of native produce. And a similar thing with Attica in Melbourne, headed up by Ben Shuri, very focused on using ethically sourced native produce. And then more locally, you've got bars like my bar, Bulletin Place in Circular Quay. You've got a bar called Isabel in Bondi, and a bar called PS40. But to be honest, nowadays, if you were to go to any kind of top tier bar or restaurant in any of Australia's major capital cities, chances are you're going to find some item of native produce, be it just something like lemon myrtle or finger lime or anything common like that. You're starting to see much more prevalently.
Yeah, well, that's a good place to go with the next question. In your article, you identify a moral issue and an economic issue when it comes to bars and restaurants using these ingredients. Do you want to give us an idea of what those issues are?
Absolutely. I mean, the major one is that from grower through to exporter through to kind of farm management, Indigenous Australians are represented in only 1% of that total supply chain, which means minimal representation means the inevitable loss of all of that cultural knowledge. And for me, what makes those ingredients so special is not, you know, how well it pairs with different food or, you know, what it tastes like. It's the 60,000-70,000 year history that's attached to it. And that's by not remaining inclusive and not allowing Indigenous Australians to take kind of financial ownership of the ingredients that have always been theirs. We are at risk of losing a very kind of long and visceral connection to Australia.
Could you perhaps give us an example of how traditional knowledge has potentially been exploited in the past and Indigenous involvement being bypassed when it comes to native ingredients?
I mean, just generally speaking, you've got finger lime plantations throughout Southeast Asia, and you've got Davidson plum starting to be grown in, you know, California. But more specifically, listeners might be familiar with the tea plant Gumby Gumby. It's a traditional tea plant that was used for thousands of years for medical purposes, you know, to treat kind of sprains and flu and cold. But essentially, two Queensland business owners began to grow this plant, harvest it, produce this tea, and claim that they invented the name Gumby Gumby. And since then, they began to kind of produce these cease and desist letters and sent them to Aboriginal businesses that were using the name. Now, this plant has been called Gumby Gumby for thousands and thousands of years, but because they've now got a patent, they're stripping that kind of ownership away from Aboriginal businesses, which is a little bit irksome, you know. It's very irksome.
How do you think that this issue should be addressed correctly by all the different levels of the supply chain right through to bars like yours and other restaurants?
It's complex. It's super complex. I think from the perspective of a bar manager, you just have to remain conscientious about where you're purchasing from. You have to ensure that if you're using native peach and native plum, you know what company it came from, you know whether or not they are indigenously owned, or whether they provide employment for indigenous communities. Remaining kind of educated about the product that you're putting in a glass or on the plate is at the very minimum what bar managers should be doing. Beyond that, it's really difficult for me to know because this is such a complex problem. I think just kind of having these conversations, and developing trusting relationships with suppliers is a good way to start as well. But really kind of just remaining conscious about where your produce is coming from is, I guess, the overarching message.
In your bar, do you find ways of educating your customers about the produce?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if people are interested, and your staff are properly trained, you should be able to tell a story about everything, every piece of produce that you put in the glass. And that's what we kind of pride ourselves on at Bulletin. We can tell you where our just regular limes came from, as much as we can tell you about where our macadamia came from. But in terms of kind of communicating that cultural knowledge, it's less our responsibility to do that, I think, and more our responsibility to ensure that our dollar power, our buying power contributes to retaining that cultural knowledge, I guess.
Now, you've also identified there is an increased interest and an increased demand for different types of native produce. How do you see supply meeting demand in an ethical way?
Absolutely. It's such a danger that all of that knowledge and communities will kind of be exploited and people left on the ground while those big players take off with that increasing demand. It's if there's not enough ethical supply to meet our demand, is it a question of whether or not we should stop demanding or whether we just continue to buy from the big players? And I think if we continue to do the latter, it puts Indigenous Australians in a really kind of unfortunate position. Ensuring that our money goes to the right place and kind of hoping that that demand doesn't outstrip what is able to be supplied, then I think, yeah, I guess that's a good start. But it's a really interesting question.
We do have this increase in interest. We do have this increase in demand. Have you thought about what sorts of opportunities may now present themselves with this increase, with this movement?
For the supplier end, you would hope that there's increased kind of financial gains on a very kind of surface level. On a deeper level, you would hope that because people are becoming more interested and buying more conscientiously, the communication of knowledge is becoming easier and the access to that knowledge is becoming easier. On a consumer end, I think the growth in all of this produce allows us to kind of hold our head high and be able to transmit an image of our country that we haven't particularly been very educated on for a very long time. I mean, think back 10 years ago, if someone came overseas and asked you what Australian cuisine was, you'd be hard pressed to go beyond, a Lamington and a meat pie and that kind of that stereotypical view. And now we're coming into our own, I guess. I guess Australia's beginning to wake up. So it's a very exciting period, I think, for bars and restaurants.
If there are people out there, maybe chefs or bar owners or things like that, that are looking into using native produce, or if there's people looking into using it at home, would you be able to give us some direction on how to find suppliers who are doing things the right way?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I guess my main supplier at the bar is a company called Something Wild, and they supply everything from kind of game meats through to native herbs and native fruits. So you can jump online, hit somethingwild.com.au, and have a look through their product portfolio, but it's all 100% indigenously owned. The guy, Dan Motlop, I think used to play AFL for Port Adelaide. So our listeners might recognize the name. More locally, you've got Australia's first dedicated rooftop garden in Everleigh, in Redfern. And it's this, you go up this kind of this modern building and then you hit this rooftop and it's this beautiful kind of urban oasis where they describe themselves as a library of the oldest continuous civilization on the planet. So you go up there and they run classes. They've got 2,000 different species of plants. They're not a commercial entity, but they are educational and a good way to introduce yourself to that produce. So yarrabingan.com.au in Redfern. Another one, Indigigrow in La Perouse. If you are looking to, plant some native herbs and fruits in your backyard, they are essentially a native Australian nursery. All of these companies employ or are owned by Indigenous families, and I think that's where you need to start. You need to start with companies like this.
All right, fantastic. We'll leave it there. Evan Strove from Bulletin Place, thank you so much for joining me on 2SER this morning.
Mate, thank you. That was great.